Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:20 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and that's on September 30th, which also happens to be the end of the third quarter. I thought we'd kick off with the USA's budget balance as a percentage of GDP. There are, I think, two rather important points. There have only been two occasions in the last 50 years when the USA ran a positive budget surplus. And that was right at the end of the 1960s and right at the end of the 2000s. So, one thing that we can, I think, draw the conclusion is that following each one of these occasions, when there was a budget surplus, immediately afterwards there were record deficits. So we can, it might sound cynical, but the one thing that we can rely on politicians to do when they have money is spend it. So we've definitely seen that since 2000, and we can label it any way we want, whether that was in response to the crash in the Nasdaq, 9/11, and the shock value that that had, then the credit crisis, subsequently the pandemic. We've definitely seen on multiple occasions there have been no end of opportunities to massively increase deficit spending. Now let's go back and think about the 1970s. Well, we can also see that immediately after the budget surplus in 1969 and 1970, spending increased. Deficits were expanded at each subsequent challenge. Now, it's not to say that there weren't exogenous factors. There were. We had massive social unrest, an unpopular war. And then there was the oil crises, and these were really significant issues. There was a sequence of lower rally highs in the budget deficit between 1970 and approximately 1994, or I guess 1994. So this long period lasted for about 24 years. Now we also have a sequence of lower rally highs. And the peak was in 2001. So we've been going on now for 21 years already. And the budget balance is back in the region of the sequence of lower rally highs. So we're at the key point now, whether we're going to see an additional swing and at a another bout of really significant budget deficit spending, or are we going to go into a more stable period? Now, of course, we have inflationary pressures right now, but it's not like inflation is suddenly going to result in the US government solving for its debt issues. And then we can also think about the question for that remains outstanding for the bond market, which is how are they going to fund the rising interest expense of government debt? So obviously this is becoming more problematic. We've already seen this week that the UK had to intervene in no uncertain terms in the long end of the bond market, and they're looking at compressing maturities at anything north of a 20-year maturity. But ultimately, that was about pension liabilities. It's very akin to what happened with long-term capital management, in that it was a big fund went bust and then had knock-on effects for large numbers of banks. Well, on this occasion, it was a large number of pension funds. We're getting 100 million pound margin calls, and they were selling or forced sellers of government debt so that the recently issued half of 1%, 2061 UK sovereign bond traded down to a price of about 26, 25, or 26p on the pound. So that's a crash environment when something trades down 75%, and the Bank of England had to intervene. Of course, what that also then raises the prospect of is what will need to happen for the Federal Reserve to begin to loosen up monetary policy again, and will we have to have a crisis so that the US government will agree to an additional stimulus package? And of course, the political makeup of the government is obviously going to be a factor there, and we're going to have the midterm elections in little more than a month. Now, there is an additional, I think, important point. We can think about the big bull markets in gold, and it was immediately after budget surpluses in the USA that these big bull markets started. And they didn't end until interest rates had gone up enough to instill some strength into the dollar. So let's look at the long-term price of gold. So we are well aware of the big bull market that happened in the early 2000s and the big bull market that peaked in 1980. But we also can then think about the fact that it was in 1968 that gold started to move, and then it was breaking out in 1972. So the causal factor was that they were devaluing the dollar by increasing spending, and the surplus turned into a significant deficit, and they were basically monetizing the debt. And then that contributed to a search for a safe haven, and gold was recently decoupled from the dollar, so it really started to accelerate relative to the dollar. And then in 2000, well, the government started spending in an aggressive manner, and that was in response to the crash in the Nasdaq and then 9/11. And the dollar started trending downwards, emerging markets started trending upwards, and gold took off. And it went into this sequence of ranges, one above another, and then accelerated from the nadir of the global financial crisis. So now we are back in the region of about $1,660, and the price broke down last week and then started to steady in here this week. And it's not yet convincing. We had an upward. An upside key day reversal on Wednesday. And we also had an upside key day reversal back in July. And that gave way to a good sized rally. But it's not able to hold its move in here today. And it is really moving in lockstep with the dollar. So the dollar has been consolidating for the last 3 days. We still have a sequence of ranges, more or less one above the other. And until it breaks the sequence of higher reaction lows, then we have to continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So, the two things that really help to support a big bull market in gold are negative real interest rates and a weaker dollar. So, we have negative real interest rates. Inflation is way above where the Fed funds rate is, and that's true of the majority of markets. But that's not a sufficient condition. We can just look back at what gold has been doing for the last decade. Prices today are not all that different to where they were between 2011 and 2013. And we've had a lot of back and forth in between. And in all that time, we've had negative real interest rates. So negative real interest rates have sustained prices, but will not contribute to a big move up in the price until gold is performing in all currencies. So gold is performing in some. It's particularly performing well in the pound and in the euro. So in the euro, or when quoted in euros, it's firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. The pound has been under significant duress and then bounced somewhat here in this week. So it got all the way up to test the highs and then pulled back again. Now let's just think for a moment about what happened in the UK. Well, the pound got down to about 105 and then rebounded by about 6 cents. So it's a big tail on the candle. It's a low of at least near-term significance, and we're likely to see an unwinding of the short-term oversold condition. But I do wonder whether we've seen a lot of that unwinding already occur. When we just zoom in and look at this on a daily basis, we're coming up into the region of the sequence of lower rally highs. The big downward dynamic that we saw at the end of last week has pretty much been unwound already. And it's not like the Bank of England has already raised rates to prohibitive levels to really snuff out demand and kill off inflation. The big challenge is that until last week, they were still talking about reducing the size of the balance sheet and engaging quantitative tightening. Well, that's pretty much gone out the window this week because of the panicky environment in the gilt markets. But the UK still has inflation running at about 9.9%. So, and that's of course on a year-over-year basis. How on earth is the Bank of England going to bring down inflation when they're constrained from sharply raising interest rates by the pressure that's already coming to bear on the pension sector? So this is an exceptionally difficult environment, and they're basically being posed with a question. Are they going to give greater weighting to rescuing the pension sector or combating inflation? And I think the answer is they're definitely going to favor the pension sector. They can't have pensions going bust. It might be cheaper to just give the money to the pensions than it is to go in and try and rescue the entire gilt market, but that decision has already been made. Now, the next question is, well, what happens next? Are they going to be able to raise rates? And are they going to raise rates and then increase the cost of borrowing for the government by letting other parts of the yield curve advance? And I think that's probably what's going to happen. So if we look at the yield curve for the UK, well, what we're going to see now is a very sharp inversion. So everything from about 6 months forward yields more than the 40 and 50 year. So this is an exceptionally inverted yield curve, and we have almost every point on the curve inverted. So it's pricing in exceptionally tight short-term conditions. And we don't have quite the same long history of inverted yield curves being an indicator for recessions in the UK as we do in the USA. But I think it's well understood with the cost of containing some of the price pressures on electricity, which are going to go into effect tomorrow, and the inability to raise taxes, and the current government promising to reduce taxes with no real way of paying for it. These are clearly inflationary issues. So we've had the repercussions of financial engineering really affecting the pension sector on one hand, and then we have the unfortunately the low quality of politicians affecting the economy on the other. It's obviously an open question how long Liz Truss is in fact going to be in her position, and the ability of populism to continue to hold sway among the UK population is probably wearing quite thin. But the reality is that the economy is under significant duress, and the Bank of England is in an exceptionally tight position. So they may simply be looking at leverage ratios within the pension sector, and once that issue has been solved, they will probably seek to end this emergency action. Now, of course, the cynic will say that there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government policy. So obviously we can't discount the possibility that the UK is going to be stuck trying to manage the yield curve for a really prolonged period. But we do have the example of Japan. Now, Japan's yield curve control program is rather different because they're trying to create inflation. But one thing is clear, and it is that they don't have an inverted yield curve. Now, obviously, it's not a very wide one. They have 1 month rates that are negative, and they have 40-year rates that are around 1.5%. But the only point on the curve that is inverted is the 10-year, and they're deliberately targeting the 10-year, and they're not going to allow the yield to exceed 25 basis points. But everything else is looking fine. So this is kind of like partial yield curve control. It's quite possible that the UK will continue to do the same thing. They will compress long dated yields because the UK government, most of their debt has got a duration in excess of 12 years. So that at least is something that's very positive for the UK because the government, yes, it has issues with the pension sector, but there's no immediate need to go out and try and or have to refinance that debt because so much of it has a very long tenure. And if that's the case, then the Bank of England may continue to raise rates and only target a very specific part of the curve rather than targeting the entire curve. So it's not like we are at the end of the yield curve control program. And it's likely that what's happened in the UK in response to a financial sector problem is going to be repeated elsewhere. And it's certainly not the only country that's going to run into trouble with sectors that aren't supposed to be levered becoming levered, and also with an acute need to intervene because of market dislocations. But obviously, then, the other point is that the markets are having a or they have a very short time, or they have a very short patience window for excitable politicians. So if we see these same kinds of irresponsible tax cuts with no real, even just cursory attention to fiscal detail, then those countries are also going to be punished. But then we can think about what's the Fed going to do? Well, let's look at the full yield curve for the Federal Reserve. And usually, by the time a recession starts, the entire yield curve is inverted. And we certainly have an inversion between the 2 year and the 10 year. And we have inversions between the 20 and the 30 year, and all the way from 4 years out to 10 years. So, an inversion from the between the 2 year and the 10 year is a reliable lead indicator for a future recession. We don't yet have an inversion between the 3 month and the 10 year, but it's inevitable. It will happen eventually, and we can look at that chart. It was artificially high in May of this year, and it has compressed meaningfully. Now, that yield curve has advanced in here this week because investors are willing to bet that the Federal Reserve is now much closer to cutting interest rates, making additional liquidity available now than it was previously because of what's happened in the UK. But the Federal Reserve has not achieved its goals and does not have the financial sector stress that the UK does. And the USA is an energy exporter. Natural gas prices are coming down. In fact, natural gas prices are coming down in Europe as well. So US natural gas prices are down from 10 to 6.8 or $6.80, and that's a meaningful pullback. So it's the first area of potential support, and it's steadying from the region of the 200-day moving average. If it breaks down from here, well, then the potential is that it'll come back down to test the $4 area. But we are seeing that natural gas prices have fallen in Europe as well. And what I find particularly interesting is that we haven't seen a lot of panic in the gas markets because of this Nord Stream pipeline getting broken. So I've seen a huge amount of speculation about who did it. The first thing that I think is important is that Freeport LNG terminal in South Texas that blew up in June. That is now being sus there's some speculation around that that was also a deliberate event. And the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 pipelines being punctured was also a deliberate act. Let's set aside the question of who did it and instead think about what the repercussions are. Well, the first is that with holes in the pipeline, there's no prospect of gas coming through them and supplying Europe. So the war in Ukraine is not over. Now, there's no question that Russia has experienced some setbacks on the battlefield. And the Putin administration is not in a position to accept defeat. So the one thing, and I think it's been well understood by military analysts, is that Russia has the material. They have the tanks, they have the armored vehicles, they have the trucks to propagate this war. They don't have the active service military people. Ukraine does not have the armaments, but it does have the people. So they've called up everyone in the country. So they have the people. And now the question is, what's NATO going to do about supplying Ukraine with the materials they require? So Germany has said in very clear terms they're not going to send tanks, but other countries probably will. And the USA, the UK, and other countries have already sent a significant portion of their inventory of the shoulder-mounted missiles and then these more advanced pieces of artillery. So isn't it possible that what Russia is going to do is akin to what Iran did during the Iran-Iraq war, which was they put up a wall of soldiers and they basically piled bodies at the border until Iraq gave up. And maybe that is what Russia intends to do. They've called up 300,000 people. Is Putin willing to sacrifice 300,000 soldiers in order to achieve his military goals? Because what he might be trying to do is simply force NATO to run out of weaponry. And perhaps not weaponry, but potentially run out of ammunition. That's a realistic possibility. Now, it's certainly not something that anyone wants to countenance, but if you're thinking about your enemy as being truly desperate, the alternative to that would be strategic nuclear weapons. So they're probably, and obviously that's a much worse potential outcome, and so much worse that nobody wants to consider it as a realistic possibility. But the one thing we know now is that Russia has been isolated, and the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines, well, that just increases the isolation. But if Russia thinks that it's losing this war, it has absolutely no incentive to sell its products to Europe. And Europe is already talking about the need to put a price cap on its imports from Russia. Now, how on earth they're going to be able to enforce that is beyond my comprehension. But it's not taking into account that Russia can simply decide not to sell. And then Europe is in a really rather difficult position. Now, as we think about oil prices, Brent crude is back below the $90 area. And we're still seeing a sequence of lower rally highs. $80 on Brent crude is the upper side of the underlying range, and the price isn't rallying. So we have two very competing arguments. The first is that there's less supply, and therefore, and with all this uncertainty, that's going to support prices. We're in an energy shock environment, so there's a real supply issue. And there's obviously a lot of data to support that. But the other is that growth is slowing down. The European consumption of oil and gas is contracting meaningfully. We see in the hospitality sector that hot tubs are being shut down, swimming pools are no longer being heated. Non-essential pieces of infrastructure are being shut down. Obviously, that's restricting demand. And then, of course, we have metal bashing, metal smelting operations that are getting shut down. So, obviously, that's going to hit demand. And as we move more into a recessionary environment, then demand is destruction is going to be a significant factor. So you have these two competing arguments, but the price is falling. Now it's not falling aggressively because recessions haven't yet been confirmed, but the price is falling. So this is removing some of the stress. It's also creating an issue for Russia and for other energy exporters. So it's certainly a very difficult environment. Now, when we think then about the stock market, let's just think about the sectors that have done best and just address the consistency. So The Nasdaq 100 trended higher in a beautifully consistent manner for 12 years and accelerated between March of 2020 and the end of 2021. The index went from less than 7,000 to over 16,000 in the space of little more than a year. So that was a really significant acceleration of the previous trend. Now, there has not been an occasion when the index traded below the 1,000-day moving average since 2009. And it tested it in June, and we had a substantial rebound. And it is closing out the week below this level again in here this week. We are potentially at the end of what has been a secular bull market for the Nasdaq. Now, when I wrote Crowd Money, the themes that I was thinking about were that energy prices would stay low for a prolonged period because we'd already been through a phenomenal bull market and the USA was on the cusp of becoming energy independent, and that it would take a decade at least for a new source of demand for natural gas to arrive. So we would have low energy prices and that would support at a bull market. Well, we've had that. I was looking at technological innovation. I was thinking that we have these wonderful inventions that are coming out, and these companies are benefiting again from globalization. So that was the third theme, that we would have this phenomenal advance because companies were building truly global franchises. And the companies that were going global were among the biggest beneficiaries of the technological innovation. So, and then we also had the rise of the global consumer. So it's not simply that companies were going international and that globalization was resulting in higher profitability for companies, but also that we have seen large numbers of countries moving into their demographic dividend period, and that it would contribute to big bull markets because of literally billions of new consumers. So those were the four primary themes of the last decade. Well, oil prices are now high. Globalization is rolling over. The demographic dividend in China is pretty much over. And only starting really to fire in places like India and Africa. And we have higher geopolitical tensions now, much more debt, and rising inflation. So not only have we had the primary tailwinds of the big bull market come under threat, but new threats have arisen, and the price action is rolling over. So this is significant. So we had the bullish themes that were attracting investor interest over the last decade. But you cannot have a secular bull market without liquidity. So we've had a fountain of global liquidity for most of the last 14 years. Every single time the market has pulled back, the Federal Reserve and other central banks have waded in with significant additional new money. And that phenomenal availability of new cash has been the causal factor in the big bounces we've seen, whether that's in 2009, 10, or 11, 2015 and 16, 2018, 2020, and even in this was, I think, the big counter example. In June of this year, we had a bounce from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, but no evidence of central bank support. And subsequently, the price has just turned around and come back down. So, this is a major trend in consistency. The Nasdaq has encountered resistance twice, in the region of the 200-day moving average. And now it's breaking down to new reaction lows, and it's below the 1,000-day moving average. This isn't just a completing top formation. This is a downtrend. The only thing that's going to rescue this bull market is massive monetary and fiscal stimulus. Now, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, but I still think that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise rates until something breaks. Now, we've seen something break in the UK, and you definitely see more commentators over the last few days talking about the possibility that the Fed is closer to the peak of the interest rate cycle than they had been. But perhaps the other way of saying it is that they're not going to stop raising rates until they're given a reason. And so far, they haven't been given a reason. Now, demand for repo has gone through the absolute roof. It's up to 2.5 trillion. So this has been a huge move into cash and demand for money market instruments. So money is getting pulled out of the stock market, and a lot of people are in cash. And private equity has over 3 trillion in dry powder. So it's not like there isn't cash around to support a new bull market, but there will have to be a catalyst to encourage that money back into the market. And then, are we going to see the same sectors fire? When I think about the Fang Man companies, one of the things I'm most interested in is that the Fang Man Index looks eerily similar to the NASDAQ, but it is still outperforming. It hasn't yet broken through the 1,000-day moving average. And when we look at their performance relative to the entire market, then we're down towards the lower side of the over of this range, which continues to look like a top formation. Now, I think it's especially interesting to look at the cloud computing sector. In 2021, people were still talking about the total addressable market being much larger than has already been gained. The blue sky environment for growth. Whereas now we're seeing that CIOs are talking about the failure of the cloud to deliver on the savings they were expecting, and that they're going to be much more careful about making decisions, and sometimes it might even be cheaper to do things internally. Now, that's really problematic. When we think about companies like Rackspace, it's a company that is infrastructure software. Lumen Technologies is infrastructure software and breaking down. Now, let's just think then about Salesforce. So it's another cloud computing company and breaking downwards. You have front-end software, you have middle market or back-end software, you have hardware. And as the trend persists, the middle market software becomes commoditized. And a company like Salesforce will then go to their customers and say, "We'll throw it in for free." So you're going to get a significant contraction in that middleware sector and our middle software sector, where they're all competing for the same market and their offerings are largely commoditized. So a lot of those companies are going to disappear. And if those companies disappear and they use, and then let's think about these, the SPAC index and the IPO index. One of the big innovations for the startup culture for the last decade has been that they don't have to have big server farms. They don't have to rent the space. They don't have to hire the people. They can simply outsource all of that data management to the big companies. Well, the IPO index has given up all of the 2020 advance, and it's barely steady. Now, Amazon is, with its web services division, is barely steady. It's got the very clear overhead top formation, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. This is a downtrend. Google does lots of interesting things, but the share is breaking downwards. They abandoned their cloud gaming service in here today, Stadia, and the share is back below the 1,000-day moving average. So, if the cloud computing software sector is failing, then the cloud computing hardware sector is also going to come under pressure, and there'll be fewer customers queuing at the door to get rack space or get access to their data warehouses. So that's a negative. And then we have to think about what was really successful for Google. So they developed search, but they sold advertising, and it revolutionized the advertising sector. So now everybody wants to be an advertiser. And this is, I think, very similar to this total addressable market issue that has been within the cloud computing sector. Everybody wants to be an advertising company now. Apple has basically created a walled garden around the App Store and is charging exorbitant sums to advertise within it, or at least is planning to. Google already is a major advertiser. Facebook's a major advertiser. Amazon is now charging significant sums for all its sellers to become advertisers. And of course, what this is doing is it's creating a lot more hands reaching out for finite advertising spend. And in a recessionary environment where share prices are falling, where earnings are under threat, then how many companies are going to be boosting their ad sales? The most important thing is, I've talked to the CIO of a very large PR advertising company that helps companies to distribute their spend, and he said that they haven't seen any pullback in spending yet. But the share prices tell us that it's absolutely inevitable. Then let's just think about some of the companies that people rely on. So Coca-Cola is pulling back in a dynamic manner. And one of the challenges that it faces is that it yields 3.3%, but the 2-year yield is, and let me just get the exact figure, 4.25, and still rising. So what we're going to see with these kinds of companies is that we're going to see yields rising. Now, let me just graph the yield. This is the just defaults to market cap. So generally speaking, over the last 14 years, yields of 3.5% on many of these dividend aristocrats have been more than attractive. And it's been the point at which investors stepped in and then really wanted to buy with both hands. But It's arguable whether that's going to be enough in this environment because of the competing clauses with the bond market. So Colgate, Palmolive is coming up to a yield now of about 2.6%, and that's not all that far away from where it peaked. But what this is giving us is a very clear picture of the need for rising yields. Now, a secular bear market is defined as a generational long period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. So the dividend paying stocks are experiencing a lot of pressure to increase their dividend yield. And that can be obviously achieved by increasing their dividend, or buying back shares. But they're going to have to be certainly, they're certainly under pressure to do that. Now, let's think at, for example, with Pepsi, where the share has held up somewhat better, and the yield hasn't been under quite the same pressure, but it is now also pulling back. So even the companies which have the most predictable cash flows and have got exceptionally lengthy histories of increasing dividends, well, they're now also coming under pressure because their dividend yield isn't attractive enough. Now, these will also be the kinds of companies that will bounce first, because what most investors don't pay attention to, but dividend investors who've held onto shares for lengthy periods of time are more than familiar with, is that you have a yield to cost advantage. So when you buy these kinds of companies on the dip, where and I don't mean a small dip, I mean a big dip where their yield surges, then you're capturing that yield at that price. But the longer you hold it for, the more yield you get, because they will continue to raise their dividend and the share price will recover. So then your basis is always going to be the point at which you bought it at. So the dividend to cost is a very different calculation to dividend yield on the current price, which is why these types of shares rebound very quickly after big declines. And we are looking at those kinds of potential opportunities in the next 6 months, because I do believe we're going to move towards a problem. There is going to be a significant problem arises, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's more pensions. We've already seen that it's a pension problem in the UK, and it's also pension problems are going to arise everywhere else. So there's one of the family offices that I advise, and they were very early in investing in Generate Capital. And when they eventually sold it, and they held it for about 7 or 8 years, and I think they sold out in the fifth or sixth funding round. Well, in addition to capturing thousands of percent in capital gain, what I found especially interesting was that it was the Australian Teachers Union and the California Teachers Union were the buyers of that position. So the first thing is that they're buying private assets which are not marked to market. And then they're not buying early stage either. They're buying when the company has already grown, where it's reasonably mature, and they're coming in and paying top dollar. So they're buying hard to value assets at multiples of where they would have traded only a couple of years ago. And when the mark to market eventually is forced upon these pensions, they're going to have huge shortfalls. And rising yields are significantly problematic. Now, when we think about when will the Fed pivot and what will it look like when it does? Well, I suspect that we are going to have a recession. But when we think about when does the liquidity become really effective? Well, we know that there's a lagged effect from rising interest rates, and we're only just beginning to see that now. There's also a lagged effect from stimulus, and the stimulus hasn't been released just yet. Now, Bitcoin prices are down heavily from the peak at the end of last year, and still trading around the 19,000 level, which is more or less the same as the peak from back in 2017. But this is the point in the cycle, a year after the cyclical peak, that we can anticipate the crypto winter, and that is what we're getting. The big moves in Bitcoin tend to be highly cyclical, and they come after the halving, and they're accompanied by massive monetary and fiscal stimulus. So, if that cyclicality is going to remain true, then we should anticipate that we're going to still have tight monetary conditions for at least another year, and that the halving won't be until 2024. So, that would suggest that we're still quite a way from when the big money spinning recovery is likely. In the short term, I think that the risk of a significant drawdown is rising, that we're seeing companies beginning to experience sales issues. And I think that's especially true for Apple. So they released their new phones last week, and then announced that this week that they're canceling some of their production because nobody wants to buy them. And that also brings forward the point that Apple is a highly cyclical company, and people don't buy them until their old one, the battery starts failing. So that suggests that Apple is going to be in a difficult sales environment for at least another 2 years, and the share continues to contract. And this is also indicative of the cyclicality that we're seeing in the semiconductors sector. And this is exceptionally reminiscent of what we saw in the late 1990s. Everyone was terrified of Y2K. So they went out and bought new stuff, and that created a huge demand surge. There was massive investment in all kinds of technological infrastructure. It created huge demand for chips. Fabs were built at huge expense. Demand evaporated after Y2K into a rising interest rate environment, and then there was a triple waterfall crash. So we had the Nasdaq collapse. There was no more demand, no more investment, and yet supply of chips went through the roof, and the companies, the factories have to continue to produce them even when sales are falling because they need to claw back the expense of building the factories. So in 2020, we had a very similar situation. Everyone suddenly had to work from home. Everybody needed a new phone, a new computer, new stuff. As one of my tennis buddies, he's got a Wi-Fi connected water bottle. And we all had a good giggle about what a nonsense product it is, and yet he loves it, and it's lots of fun. There's been lots of these nonsensical products created that people don't need, and yet they buy. They all require chips, they all have Wi-Fi connections, and in a recession, people stop buying crap. So we're in a very similar situation today. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been allocated to build new semiconductor fabs. How many of them, in fact, get built is going to be very, I think, integral to the ability of the sector to recover. But because of geopolitical tensions, a lot of those fabs are going to be built. There's going to be a huge amount of supply. And that suggests that the semiconductors index is going to give up all of its bull market. And it's going to be a very similar situation to what we had in 2000 through 2003, and then subsequently from 2003 through to 2014. This is a perfect candidate for a type 3 bottoming characteristic following the crash environment, because there's just a wall of supply about to hit the market into a recessionary environment. What all of this clearly states is that the technology growth sector of the market is far and away the riskiest part of the market right now. Now, it doesn't mean that there won't be some success stories. When we think about another highly cyclical company, Illumina, well, they've brought out their new machine today, and it's going to sequence DNA for $200 instead of $600. So that's a significant new iteration, and the share is at the lower side of its range. But it's probably going to need to start selling them in order to convince investors that it's worth jumping in when everything else is under pressure. When we then think about what are the things that are going to lead us out of this environment, well, infrastructure development is going to be absolutely essential. We're going to be building new power plants, new high-tension cables, and there's going to be massive investment in energy independence infrastructure all over the world, but most particularly in Europe. So that's obviously going to be beneficial for copper, but not until that money is actually beginning to be spent. And copper prices are hovering here below the 1,000-day moving average. When we think about where the potential for new liquidity is going to come from, well, what happens in China is going to be the linchpin, because they have to try and rescue their property sector, and they're trying to manage the depreciation of the currency. So they're instructing the banking sector to start selling dollars. So they're trying to arrest the decline of the currency, but they can't spend money themselves to rescue the currency when they're also spending money to try and support the stock market and keep interest rates low. You can't have both. Obviously, what happens in China with regard to demand is especially important because they consume more than half of all copper. So the price at the moment is stable, but it is still below the 1,000-day moving average. And aluminium is another important commodity which isn't expensive at today's levels and gave up at this week's advance by the close in here today. There's speculation that the LME is going to stop receiving Russian aluminium supplies, and aluminium is substituted for copper whenever copper prices are expensive, particularly in electricity transmission. But we're not yet at the point where it is a slam dunk to just jump in and buy industrial commodities. This is going to be a story for after the recession. We haven't even started the recessions yet. There's still a lot of we're still at that inter, I guess the lull between when monetary conditions begin to tighten and when the full effects are felt. And this is a time more to take money off the table, to have some speculative short positions, so that when those short positions stop working, that's usually a good indication that the demand component of the market is back in control. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.